Welcome to From Doubt to Drive, Entrepreneurs Only. Join us on an inspired journey through the ups and downs of successful entrepreneurs. Our hosts, Mario C. Bauer and Florian Schneider, will explore how conquering doubt is essential for entrepreneurs to truly unleash drive. By being a part of our community, you too can learn how to propel from doubt to drive. So tune in, buckle up, and enjoy.
So today I'm very excited. So today we have a very special guest for me. He's not just a friend and a mentor. I think he's one of the leaders everybody in our industry is looking at, because he started an amazing successful career, first with E2, then he switched sides, was running Pret & Marché. We're going to talk about that, hopefully. Very successful till the exit to JAB. And now he's an acting chairman and still one of the main investors at E2. So let's welcome our friend, Clive.
Maybe we start with you. What was the biggest success, the most positive thing you remember when you think back to your time as a CEO of Pret?
I think it's a funny question, that, because you don't really like talking about positives, so I'm having to adjust to it. I was expecting to talk about doubt.
Don't worry.
Yeah, I think it's the joy of the Pret people coming together in a in one of their big meetings, whether it be the quarter briefs when 700 people would come, or we had a thing called Partners in Pret, where just 120 people would come with their spouses, and you could celebrate the glory of the company. And I think people really responded to the Pret's better side. So when Pret did good things for the homeless, or they've done well, the people felt so proud, and we all felt so proud together. It's a wonderful human emotion. So I think I'd cite that as a very positive time.
As you like to talk about the struggles, we also wanted to start with you that journey, because it's not so easy to warm up entrepreneurs or leaders to talk about their struggles. But we always know that we can learn most about the struggles. So I think everybody can read the big success stories of Pret, and you mentioned a few things. But if you look back in your career, what are the, let's pick two moments maybe and dig a little bit deeper into that, Clive. So what is a really struggle moment you had in your career? And then we kind of dig in a little bit how you felt during that time and how you overcame that. So what is one of the moments you really struggled or hit the wall?
Well, I think the biggest struggle was the opening of the second Itsu restaurant in Soho. So this was in the year 2000, and Julian and I had a restaurant in Chelsea in London, which was very successful, and we were keen to expand it. And the natural restaurant centre of London is Soho, and we thought a site in Soho would really put us on the map. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say at the outset, for all restaurateurs, the second restaurant is the most dangerous of all restaurants, which I think Anthony Bourdain says in his book. You think, because you've got a successful first restaurant, that you know the answers. But actually, there's a lot of things going on that made the first restaurant successful that don't apply to the second. So we took an expensive site in Wardour Street, and we geared it up to open to £60,000 a week, because that's what one of our neighbours did. And we were absolutely dedicated to opening it at £60,000 a week. We got all the food in, all the staff in, and we tried to avoid all the mistakes that we'd made in the first restaurant with the design. So in the first restaurant, for example, we didn't have enough tables for 4, 5, and 6. So we had too many tables for 2. And big groups were always coming into the Chelsea restaurant, couldn't sit down. So this time we thought, well, we're clever now. We won't make that mistake. We'll have lots of tables for 4, 5, and 6. But in Soho, it's a different market. And so we opened the restaurant, and it was absolutely beautiful. But nobody came in. Simply nobody came in. They would all look at it and they would feel off put by something. And you never know what that something is. They just did not come in. We had beautiful hostesses welcoming people. We had the food going around the conveyor belt, but nobody came in. And the food began to get warmer and warmer on the conveyor belt. So all this sashimi is going around, very expensive, and nobody is coming in. And the first night, we were meant to do £7,000 and we did £600. And the second night we did 900, and the third Saturday night we did 1,200. I mean, we were heading for total disaster. And this was just a little company with one restaurant, so you couldn't lose 40,000, 50,000 pounds a week without, you know, doing something about it. And it was really, there's no way out. You can't work out how to get people to come in. You can't sample. That looks kind of weird. Print ads are pretty hopeless. It was before social media, but even that would have been tough. You have this funny feeling of the customers not coming in. And the more you try and urge the staff and try and be there and be, you know, lead yourself, it just doesn't feel right. So in the end, we did the only thing that we could do, which was to cut the prices on the wall, on the walls, on the windows. And instead of selling the plates for, this is a conveyor belt restaurant, selling these plates for £3.50 or £2.90, we sold them all for £1 a plate. Five plates for £5. And we plastered that all over the restaurant walls, you know, the windows. Mm-hmm. And then within a few minutes, everybody started coming in. So the restaurant became from being a complete morgue to being ram-packed with all sorts of kids, all sorts of everybody coming in for a cheap deal. And of course, we took enormous numbers of customers. The gross profit was negative 120% or something.
A full restaurant, but losing money. Huh?
Yeah, we did £140,000 of business in real money, in real prices, and only 20 in the cheap prices. God. And the staff were exhausted, but at least it filled the restaurant up, and we lost the debt look. And but you've still got a massive problem. But that made us limp on. We limped on, and we slowly came off the drug of the £5 plate, with £4 plate, £3 plate. So three plates for £3, two plates for £2. And then we were just about okay. And then came the second crisis, was how are we going to solve this problem of a loss-making restaurant? Mm-hmm. And I have to take my hat off to Julian here. He is the man you want to have in a crisis like this. I was, to be honest, I was absolutely exhausted by the whole thing. And I thought we should just shut the thing and go back to our first happy restaurant in Chelsea. But he doesn't give up just like that. And he and I were playing around with sushi, you know, bits of maki and bits of nigiri. We're playing around with sushi and putting it into little boxes. And we bought a chocolate box, like a Black Magic chocolate box, mm-hmm. this English brand. And we put these sushi in lines, and they made a nice, pretty, all the colors are very lovely, the tuna and the salmon, the prawn and so on. And we decided that we would put a fridge in the front door of the restaurant with these sushi boxes in it. So we bought 500 sushi boxes, and these chocolate boxes, really, and we sold these sushi boxes out the front door. And luckily in Soho, there were a lot of film production crews, and they started buying these for takeaway. And slowly, the takeaway of the business became bigger than the dining. And we had a huge trough built outside the restaurant. We had a refrigerated fridge, and we made all these various boxes. We designed very attractive packaging, 1930s Japanese prints, not like the typical ones you'd see in Harrods back in the day of the geisha girls, but very modern, you know, very, very attractive 1930s style. And this built up a restaurant of doing £25,000 a week takeaway, and it became the future for Itsu. So that failure.
So this failure actually, I mean, what I took now in my notes were two things. First of all, it's great to have a partner and not be alone, because if one kind of is almost giving up, maybe the other has more strength to power through. And the other thing is, I mean, at the end of the day, this crisis led to the successful business model of Itsu now, because you started, as you said, with a conveyor belt. But at the end of the day, because you were forced to do something, somebody of you came up with the boxes, which actually became the iconic business model afterwards. So the crisis led to the success. And that's also what Florian and me have pre-discussed, that all these crises, not all, but some of them lead to the actual success story. But what I want to dig in a little bit, Clive, when I recall correct, you invested a lot or almost all your money back then into this project. So it was not just the fear of failing as a leader or as a business person. You were always like, you could have gone bankrupt in that personally.
So how did it feel at home?
Did you tell it at home to your wife? Did you share? Was she in the boat, or kind of were hiding and not sharing the truth? How did you cope with that?
Well, she came to the opening night of the restaurant and said it was a bad design and said it would fail.
So she told, I told you, she said.
So she said, yes, too clinical. Looks like a lavatory, she said. Very helpful. So she obviously was concerned with the outcome and keen that it went well. It definitely affected me big time. I remember my bookkeeper met my mother in the street in Suffolk and said, this restaurant's not going well. You know, Clive's going grey. And then my mother said, well, he's getting to be 45. That's quite normal. And she said, no, I'm talking about his skin. So, it is very, very frightening. But funny enough, that doesn't change it that much. You've just got to do something. And there's two ways of doing something. Well, either you pulled out or you powered through, as you say. And Julian is more of the power through kind of guy. So that was very helpful.
And looking back into this crisis or other crisis you had, which we're going to feature in a second, do you think it's more important to, as you said, to do something and do and keep on trial and error? Or would you more recommend to kind of huddle, think, and then do something? Because very often in such crisis, as an entrepreneur, you have the urge to do something. But I'm never sure, and it would be interesting to pick your brain, is it better to kind of calm down, sleep over it, discuss, call some people, and do something in a week or two from now? Or is it more important just to do something like you did, just like cross out the prices and let's do something? What do you think?
I think you have to do something. Action generates its own momentum and things will change. If you don't change the game, you can tie yourself up in knots. Nothing seems very attractive. It's not very attractive cutting your prices to nothing. It's not very attractive shutting a restaurant. You know, there's no easy solution. You're never going to you're never going to know you're right. In fact, that I think the interesting thing about Julian is he is able to convey more conviction per square centimeter on any sentence than any other human being I've met. So he will power you through by the sheer strength of his conviction. And that's very helpful because it helps you overcome doubt.
You say don't sit too long within the crisis, basically. Don't sit too long into their act.
No, just keep, you've got to keep moving.
Florian, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, actually, because you said Julian was the convincing factor. If you don't have if you would not have a convincing factor, what should you do then? I mean, doubt is.
Well, then you have to. I mean, people make decisions in different ways. You have to, maybe you're the kind of person who says, well, there's five factors we're going to make the decision in. This is the one that wins the decision making score. We're going to do that one. You'll have to intellectually get behind a narrow win, like a 51%, 49%. Win, you have to go with the 51 and you have to power through on the 51. And big democratic changes have been made in society on a 51-49, the end of slavery, the execution of Charles I, Brexit. I mean, they've been made on slim majorities, but with a lot of conviction. And you have to use that democratic conviction, I guess, if you can't get there by just sheer willpower.
On a side note, it's interesting to mention execution and Brexit in the same sentence. But anyway, I think you picked, and I'm very thankful for that, an episode or a struggle within your second big venture, so to say, in Itsu. But if we go to the other one, to the one which is probably a little bit more well-known within our community, within Pret a Manger, you have served a very, very long time as a leader and CEO, and towards the outside, Pret has been always a big success story. As Florian said, everybody admired that. It was very, everybody wanted to work there. Looking back on that part of your career, Clive, what was a moment of struggle within Pret?
I think that there have been a couple of difficult times. The one I'll choose is the 2008-09 financial crisis. So Pret a Manger was had about 250 shops, I should think, and they were heavily related to areas of employment. So they're in the city of London and in the town centres. And when Lehman Brothers and AIG and everyone started going bust, Pret was going to be very vulnerable to having no customers at all, because unemployment was not good. With the people not coming into work in the first place, Pret sales were going to collapse. So We had just sold the business to Bridgepoint. They were in their first month. It was April 2008. And then this financial crisis kicked off. And the Pret sales moved from having been consistently 7 or 8% like-for-like positive to suddenly going 10% negative. And that was a complete shock to the ecosystem. And the reason I like it, and the reason I've selected it as the answer, is because we actually had a solution to that problem. And we'd been through crises before, and we knew a couple of things instinctively as to what to do in a crisis. And I think it's worth just repeating one thing particularly, which is that you need in a crisis to play to your strengths and not try and cover up your weaknesses. The temptation is to immediately start doing customer research, and the customer research will tell you, oh, yes, we don't mind Pret, but we think it's a bit expensive. Or we don't mind Pret, but if only they had more variety. Or we don't mind Pret, but they should have different kind of hot food. They will have all sorts of ideas for you. They'll basically tell you that you're too expensive and you should have new stuff. That's what they'll all tell you. And if you simply follow that, it probably won't be enough. You need to go back to the core of what the company stands for, back to the core strengths of why the company resonated with the customers in the first place. And in Pret's case, this was for speed of service and for happy and engaged staff. There were the two things that were really important to them, and they liked the food. So we did not invent hundreds of new sandwiches. Instead, we bought more tills, and instead we made sure the staff bonuses weren't cut, and instead we ensured the maintenance of the restaurants was done properly. So we did the exact opposite of what people do in financial crises. We invested more in maintenance, we invested more in the staff bonuses, we invested more in tills, and we got stronger on our core strengths, whereas the other people were doing what the normal things do, and they get weaker and slower. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, because this 2008 to 9 crisis was not an anti-Pret crisis. It was the growth of Tupperware was the problem. Sainsbury's Tupperware sales went up by 70%. The evil
Clingfilm.
Huh? Everyone's bringing their own, but they didn't do it for long. So that playing to your strengths was a really good thing. And then we did a couple of good customer pleasing things too. We made sure that we had some good, very affordable sandwiches at the right eye level. The egg and cress, I think 99p, fresh cress, free range egg. And we had 99p coffee, we had 99p filter coffee. 99p filter coffee is the most fantastic stuff because you can make it. The more you sell it, the fresher it is. And you make it extremely quickly. And the customers get a lot of value for it. And Pret, at a stroke, widened its market until you saw every single kind of person in London and England was coming in Britain was coming in, which was a great move to go alongside the playing according to your strengths. So you lead with the inexpensive things, but the good things, the prosciutto baguettes, were all there in the background for people to choose once they'd come in the door.
Retrospective, Clive, when you tell that story, it all sounds so easy. You say play to the strengths, which obviously is a great catchline now for us, which we're going to use up or down in our podcast now. But back then, I mean, there is a lot of people who probably think that you should do something different, like the investors, the board, etc. How do you really form this opinion and power through? Because probably back then there would have been 100 reasons not to do that and choose another strategy. How do you fight through such a core belief as a leader of the business against maybe shareholders or a board or your own management? How you go through that?
Well, I think you have to have some identifiable strengths in the company in the first place. If the company has no core strengths that it resonates with the customers, it's not going to have a very good time. But inside the people, and probably we'll talk about the shareholders in a second, but inside the people of the company, they will know instinctively about these strengths. And that will be why they work for the company in the first place. So internally, you will have no problem on a back to basic strengths program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, political parties go through this as well. You have to go through to the core strengths of what you stand for. That will always win the support of the insiders. Now, the outsiders who come in and bought into the business, they are looking for passion and conviction from the management. They are not from the industry necessarily. They are looking for passion and conviction from the management. If they see that passion and conviction, they will respond to it. So you will be able to power through. And, you know, this capacity to be, to have passion, to be convinced of your own point of view, that is a number one selling point. I mentioned that Julian had it, and I have it too. Not quite as well as he does, but those are very strong moves if you can line up. And I got very passionate about doing this for Pret, and it was the right thing to do in the end.
Mm-hmm. And Clive, how you made such decisions? Did you, with whom did you consult, or did you isolate and do yoga or praying or meditation to find that that way? Or how do you normally try to find your way out there? Do you talk to people? To what's the way out? Because you have this external crisis. Everybody has an opinion. The media is full of that. Hundreds of people around you telling you A, B, C, red, blue, green. How do you form an opinion? How much information, how much exchange you need with people to form such an opinion?
I think a lot of it comes from an instinctive understanding. And I think that the true leaders of a company, and most people are, you're very lucky if your own personality in a company fits together at the time. And when your personality in the company comes together, you have a very, you're a very fortunate person, and you should have an instinctive feeling for those strengths, that the inner workings of the company, deep inside the stomach of the company, how the juices are all flowing. And you should be able to feel that and communicate that and express that and be articulate enough to express that. And, that will then allow you to draw up a program. I mean, I always like threes and fives. I'll have a, you know, Clive's five. They used to joke too much about Clive's five. I'll go, or three or five. And I'll go, these are the three things we have to do. And you just bang those three things really hard, or those five things really hard, until no one's allowed to talk about anything else. And that way you get the conviction that you need. Because as you say, you can talk about everything forever.
Interesting.
But it shows also that you need a very resilient company. You know, you need some core strength that help you overcome those doubts and challenges in life, or in business especially.
I think you do. I think the companies that don't have those core strengths, that have not developed in their time of struggle in the later times, they haven't developed an identity as to what are the strengths, then I question whether the company's really going to be long-term competitive. I mean, unless it's got some economic advantage, I don't understand. But they need to know, the company should be able to identify those strengths, and they go back to them as inflection points. And that's not to say they don't change, because they will have to change, but they go back to those key inflection points. They know which direction to go in, which suits the strengths of the company.
You think it's a difference to overcome a difficult situation if it's externally made and blame somebody else versus a situation which you created by yourself? Because there's crisis where at the end of the day, you put yourself into that crisis and then you have to drag yourself out of the crisis. So like self-made crisis. Did you have a self-made crisis?
I think the self-made crises are always more difficult, because they're much more painful for the internal team. And for the customers, or the customers are less forgiving. An external crisis, like a financial crisis, no one ever blames you for it. They judge you on how well you react to it. But if you have one that you've made yourself, then that is very painful. Now, on the credit side, if you've made it yourself, you can unmake it, because you're the one who's created those circumstances. So your capacity to resolve it is quicker. But the public and the media view on it will be a much tougher on you.
And we talked about a lot of, you mentioned a lot about these leaders and skill set of leaders. So at the beginning of your career, you probably had a certain perception which are the personality traits you need to have as a leader. So you thought like, I need to be this or that. And now looking back on your career, what was actually really the traits which are important as a leader versus the one you believed at the beginning of the career? Is there kind of a mismatch to say, at the beginning of my career, when I started, I thought as a successful entrepreneur and leader, I needed to have A, B, C, D. And now looking back saying, okay, that's probably wrong. I didn't need to be this or that. I need to have that trait. Is there kind of a, what did you believe you needed to have versus what you actually needed?
Well, I think there's a big, when you start your career, you work for a big organization. Well, I work for a big organization, and there's a completely different mindset for when you're say, in the marketing department or you're in a support department, but between when you're made boss and when you're made CEO of something, you're suddenly given your own profit and loss account, the unleashing of commitment and passion is incredibly powerful. So, I mean, your job as a CEO of a big company is to unleash that feeling in as many people as you can. Of course, the restaurant industry is quite good for it because these restaurant managers get that in Preston and Itsu. They get that unleashing, and they get given responsibility for a profit and loss account very early on in their careers. And most people don't get that until their 30s or 40s. But in our industry, you can get that in age 22. And you are responsible for £3 million of business and 30 staff, and you are controlling that business. And that is the number one lesson for me, is how you get as many people feeling that responsibility as quickly as you can. Because that responsibility both makes the whole job have much more meaning and means you work five times as hard. I haven't answered your question, but that's my early perception.
Yeah, it is. And towards the end of the interview, I mean, you changed not a side after your active career in the management as a CEO. You changed more side. You became board member, mentor, investor. If you now from the other side, so not basically in the driver's seat, but more like as a board member or let's say investor, if one of your companies or one of your leaders in the companies you invested faces a crisis and come to you for advice, for coaching, what's normally the first tool set or the first advice you apply as a investor and board member? What do you do?
Well, I mean, the relationship with the CEO is very important, and I'm very supportive. I'm a very supportive investor. If I get behind a company, I'm almost too supportive. And I will try and support that CEO. It's a bit like Winston Churchill. You support him until the very end, until he's not the right CEO. But I will do my best to help him. And I guess do the kind of things we've been talking about, to evaluate his strategy, to evaluate how he's handling his people. Is he really motivating them? Make sure he's personally okay, or he or she is personally okay, and help them address the issues of the company. But I mean, the CEO has to be the person in charge. It can't be the chair or the backup investor. The CEO has to be built up to lead the company.
You once told me, you said as a chairman, you have two important functions. First, to pick the right CEO, and then pick the pay of the CEO. But I always also thought it's like the third one is like when it's time to let the CEO go, which is probably a difficult decision. So did you had one of these where you needed really as an, not in your active career, but more as an investor board member, where you had your CEO to let go? Because I also imagine that kind of a struggle and how to overcome that, because you're outside and still need to act and make this stuff call. Do you have one of these?
I do. I just want to say one thing before that. There's three jobs of the chair. One is to choose a CEO, one is to choose the pay of the CEO, and the third is to get the strategy of the company right. That is the chair's job too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's true.
But in answer to your question, I have had a CEO where I've had to change one, and it's a very painful business, and you do it by a combination of a cold look at the chances of this person taking the team through the problem. And if you conclude that the person is not going to take the team through the problem, which may be because they're not communicating with you and the board, it may be because they're not communicating with the team, it may be that they've gone wrong somehow, then you have to make a change. And for me, I'm very, 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 very supportive until I'm not. And it takes quite a lot to push me over. But if I'm pushed over, then it's easy for me.
And you also, I remember that now, I almost forgot it, but I remembered one of our discussions, you told me when you have this difficult situation that you need to fire somebody, you really need to do that in the first 20 seconds of the meeting.
Yeah, no, very important. Very important. Any bad news like firing has to be done in the first 30 seconds. You don't go and have a drink in the restaurant, ask them about their children's swimming results, and then fire them because they're going to really hate you.
I agree.
You say within the first 30 seconds, the bad news is given. I'm afraid you will not be working for the company by the end of the week or whatever it's going to be. And then you immediately shift the discussion to how are we going to make that happen? Not the core decision itself. It's really, It's really good advice.
Well, I think we need to come towards an end, because I think we set ourselves kind of a limit to be within 40 minutes, because otherwise we know each other, we start chatting forever. We have two more things at the end, Clive. First, we believe, we don't know yet, but we believe that a lot of entrepreneurs or people who want to become entrepreneurs will listen to that. And I think we also want to end every podcast with like an advice to an entrepreneur who struggles. So you gave a lot of thoughts already what to do, but if you now want to add one thought, if somebody is listening there which struggles in a difficult situation, what should they go to? What should they do? Is there any more to add? Because that's kind of the overall theme. What is your another of your advice recommendations based on your experience? What should they do?
I think sometimes I go to myself, well, what would the best Clive do? Or mm-hmm. I try and imagine the best person, the life I want to lead, the person I want to be. How would I get there? How would that person do that? And so I guess that was the challenge myself. I'd say to myself, well, if I was at my best, what would I do? And that way of looking at it might give a shaft of light that might give a good help to someone in trouble.
I like that. What would the best Clive do? I think that's a great end of that podcast. Thank you so much for your time, Clive. We truly appreciate that. Oh, what a podcast. I was quite nervous at the beginning because it was like a friend doing us a favor. We know that Clive doesn't like to be on that kind of podcast, so that adds the pressure. Yeah. But I think it was quite insightful. What do you think?
Great lessons to learn. I agree. What I took from this conversation with Clive is actually an interesting learning to say, okay, make a democratic decision if you are in doubt. Even 51% is a majority and something that changes the way and the direction of something. I also learned that you have a company with a strong core, good beliefs, good philosophy, good spirit, and another.
He said, "Play to the strength." I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, that sounds so simple, but I mean, I have been a lot of time in that situation, and I think most of the time you forget the core strengths of your company, and then you try to copy others, and you think, what has this company done? What has this company done? And at the end of the day, you are not playing to your strength, and you copy others. And I think that playing to your strength was a really, really important learning from Clive.
And also that you have to take action. You have to take action because action creates momentum, he said. And I think this is also something where many leaders and entrepreneurs tend to hesitate maybe too long instead of making a direction and then going in that taking that course and see where it ends.
So let's try that for him, because he said he always liked the Clive 3 or the Clive 5. So let's take the Marion Florian 5 learnings from Clive. So let's learn that from him. So number one is you have to take action in a crisis. Don't sit too long into the crisis. Take action. Learning number one. Learning number two.
Take a democratic decision. 51% is a majority.
Is enough. So I like the side comment on the execution and Brexit in one sentence. Yeah. Then third one, play to your strength. In a crisis, play to your strengths. Play to your core. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one. So that's number three. Number four.
Number four, my learning was invest more in financial crisis.
Good one. And number five was when we asked him about the advice to the young entrepreneurs, he said, what would the best version of Clive would have done? And I really think that's one, to not give excuses like that you cannot do that and this and that. Go back, sit back, lean back and say, what would the best version of myself do in such a situation? And then just do it.
Wise words.
Wise words. I think it's really great to have leaders who share their stories. From Doubt to Drive, one of the first episodes with Clive. It was really fun. Thanks, Florian.
Absolutely.
Take care,
talk
guys.
Soon. Next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. We hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we did. But sharing is not just caring. It is also empowering. So recommend this podcast to fellow entrepreneurs who might need a dose of inspiration. And don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you'll never miss out on future episodes. Thank you for being part of the community from Doubt to Drive Entrepreneurs Only. Mario and Florian are already gearing up for the next episode. Until then, stay tuned, stay driven, and we'll be back next week.